Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware. Their stainless steel cookware uses vapor technology to cook better tasting, more nutritional food. To learn more and receive 20% off, click their logo on our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we host a conversation with interesting people, people we think are interesting anyway, about my favorite subject, taste. And today we have one of the most interesting people, I think, the most interesting thinkers about food and taste and what it means to really eat and understand food. I'm welcoming to the studio here in Bushwick, Francis Lamb. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much, Mitchell.
what?
I hope I don't prove you wrong.
I guarantee you, you won't. You may know Francis. Probably you know Francis from his Twitter feed, where he tweets about sports and politics and pointing out the irony in perhaps some of the right-wingiest of right things. But you may also know Francis simply as the smart curatorial editor of Guilt Taste, which was a great experiment maybe we'll talk about in editorial and retail food marketing, perhaps, in some ways. Or
sure.
You might have known him from Gourmet, or you may probably recognize him as a judge on Top Chef Masters. I was interested to learn just yesterday, actually, that you will soon know him as an editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter, which is one of the great cookbook publishers, and I say that because they publish my books. And so
that's qualifying.
Yeah, that's absolutely qualifying. So, but I originally invited Francis on the show because of something, a conversation that he started months ago that still resonates, and it's this question of what it means to serve up, literally and figuratively, an authentic ethnic cuisine. And it's a conversation I thought we would start there and talk about this funny world we're in American cuisine, which is really made up of so many things around the world and so much of our own ambitions and bravado. And maybe we just talk about but what you think American food is. A simple, small
sure,
subject.
Sure. what is American food? There are kind of two main thoughts on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's one, this very sort of traditionalist view that American food is, well, I mean, and they're like sort of sub branches, right? So like on one hand, you have the very traditionalist view of like American food is X, Y, and Z dishes. It's
right.
Apple pie, it's mom baseball,
mm-hmm.
it's meatloaf,
hamburgers,
hot dogs.
Right.
And then again, like, you know, one of the sub branches is like, oh, American food is lame because all it is hamburgers and hot dogs. And the other sub branch is like, no, American food is amazing. It's wonderful. It's rich. It's like, it's our heritage and our history.
Okay.
And, branch you know, one. Obviously that's valid.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other, you know, main view is it's kind of anything goes, right? Because
right.
we are a nation of immigrants. Certainly our contemporary situation right now, I mean, we're looking, you know, we just had the election, the presidential election, and all you heard was, you know, one thing that was really striking is the changing demographics in our country, right?
Right.
And how, you know, Latino voters are much more active, and, you know, we have an extremely fast-growing Asian population, and all that stuff. And so it's easy to look at our world right now, our American world right now, and say, hey, you know, we're a country that is increasingly being made up of all these people coming from different parts of the world. But, you know, it's always been that way, right?
Right.
It's always been that way. So maybe people look different now. The people coming look a little bit different now than they did 100
right.
years ago,
but
it's always been in place.
Right. And Italian immigrants were as foreign and ethnic and derided as any new immigrant today.
Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. You know, I used to joke that like it was so much more exciting to be a racist 100 years ago because back then it wasn't just like, oh, I hate black people. Oh, I hate brown people. It was like you could hate all kinds of different white people
Italians
too.
And Jews. Hysterical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I guess another thing, even asking the question about what American cuisine is, points out the sort of class issues. I mean, they're underlying there. And so we consider a trip to an outer borough here in New York and a Chinese restaurant in a Chinese community to be an authentic ethnic experience. But somehow, when that food is translated to Hakkasan, a beautiful restaurant in Midtown that everyone loves to hate, then it's an inauthentic experience. And maybe we could talk about that class separation or that look, geographic separation.
Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Sure. I mean, well, I guess anytime you bring up authenticity, I think you have to get the disclaimer out of the way. And the disclaimer is authenticity is, I mean, it's always a moving target. So like what you think of as being authentic and I think of as being authentic, we can both be correct, but it's like we probably have totally different ideas of what that means.
Right.
Right. If we think about authenticity as like, oh, this is really the food as they would eat it in, you know, the place where it's from. Well, then the obvious, you know, sort of response to that is, okay, well, at what time period? You mean the food they eat it today, where it's probably been influenced by like global economy, or the food as they ate it there 100 years ago, or 600 years ago,
right.
You know, so like it's too much of a moving target, I think, for people to have really productive conversations about, because you end up like going at each other's throats, and you never really
you don't get anywhere.
Yeah, right. Establish where you came from in the first place. That said, I mean, I think the class issue is a really interesting one, and. So, you know, I think maybe the thing that you were talking about earlier, Mitchell, of me starting this conversation, which is way too generous of you to say of me, but as a piece I'd been thinking about and wrote about for the New York Times, and I think the headline they came up with was Cuisines Mastered as Acquired Tastes. And the story was about, in a lot of ways, it was about, we're asking the question of why it is that, say, American-born, American-raised chefs cooking immigrant cuisines often tend to be much more heralded and much more famous than immigrants who are cooking those cuisines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, I brought up chefs I totally respect, 100% admire, Andy Ricker,
mm-hmm.
Pak Pak, who's, you know, I'm assuming readers know this, but listeners know this, but if not, he is a... He has a family of restaurants, Thai restaurants called Pak Pak. And the idea is, like, you know, he's a white dude from like Vermont. He lives in Oregon, and he's been traveling to Thailand every year for 20 years and really like getting deep in the food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is him trying to do that food here. I also brought Rick Bayless, who for decades has been, you know, one of America's most cherished voices of and for Mexican cuisine, although he's, you know, a white dude from Oklahoma, and so on and so forth. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I totally respect these chefs and what they do. And then you have someone like Alex Stupak, who is passionately in love with Mexican food. It's not in his family at all. And he doesn't cook, quote-unquote, traditional Mexican food.
Right.
He has very modern, very personal food.
At Empalón Cocina and Empalón Taqueria.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For people listening. Or we could call them readers, too. I like that. I'm sure they like to be known as readers also. They're probably reading while they're listening, in fact.
Oh, is he saying something? He's still talking? but he's super passionate about Mexican food, and he's very, very clear that he's not trying to create, traditional Oaxacan grandmother's food.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, like, deeply moved by it, and he wants to get at it in sort of his own way. So I was looking at that, and so my question was, why is it that we look at these people and we know these people's names and we're willing to pay? I mean, this is not a small part of it. We're willing to go to the restaurants and pay $25 for a dish. But if you went to a taqueria and you were eating food just as delicious and they tried to charge you $25 for it, you're like, oh my God, it's a ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
The hell's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a big issue. I think that touches on so many things. I mean, class and culture, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
Yeah, no. And I think that's absolutely right. I think it's absolutely right. And you know, part of it is, you know, probably, Alex and Rick and Andy are using, you know, more expensive, higher quality ingredients in their cooking. And so, you know, that's one way to think about the difference in price. But if you had a little divey place in Chinatown and they were trying to use organic product and they were so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it'd be received the same way. I don't know if people would then say, oh, well, that place, yeah, we should go to this place in Chinatown and right. pay $25 an entree.
Right.
Right. There is this expectation that quote unquote ethnic foods are and should be cheap. And for some reason, and for, you know, as I tried to sort of explore it, for a lot of reasons, it seems like we either suspend that idea or we allow these chefs who, you know, tend to be photogenic, tend to be very articulate and smart, mm-hmm. articulate in English, and tend to not speak with an accent. We allow them to serve us that food mm-hmm. and we want to pay that money for it because we feel like, oh, they're ambassadors or they can translate the food right. for us or, you know, as Andy himself brought up, you know, there's this feeling that like, oh, if a white guy owns a restaurant, it's going to be cleaner. And like, you know, what's all the racial implication of that? Right.
Right. And yet at the same time, I'm thinking Keith McNally is famous for his French restaurant, Balthazar, or how many non-Italians run Italian concept restaurants. And yet there, again, we don't have that stigma or that class marker that we won't pay them or we won't appreciate them in the same way because of the I don't know, assimilation of those cuisines and those people, perhaps, or who knows.
Yeah. And maybe it's because those cuisines, like, we've established as being like, oh, okay, those are legit cuisines for high-end food.
Right.
Like,
the one thing that makes me think of, and I'm going to remind people that if they have questions, they can call us at 718-497-2128 or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. You can also tweet us at Taste Matters, HRN. But the one thing I think of as the red herring, maybe, is Japanese food, which Japanese cuisine, let's say, which came in high mm-hmm. and has always maintained a level of I don't know, authenticity and high class. And in fact, sort of when you downscale it, when you try to serve Japanese street food, everyone doesn't have a place to put that in their little food recipe box in their mind.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, Japanese, you know, we were at war with them. like in some ways, you know, we didn't really have a sweet history with them necessarily.
We put Japanese Americans right. in concentration camps.
Yeah, in fact.
Yeah. I think that's a super interesting thing. And it, you know, I think the thing that really strikes me about what you just said is it came in high, right?
Right.
For sure, there are lots of Japanese American communities in the United States, particularly on the West Coast or almost exclusively on the West Coast and Hawaii, that are really varied in class, mm-hmm. you know, lots of working class people, middle mm-hmm. class people, and wealthy people. But I wonder if, and I'm not an expert in this at all, so I'm kind of talking just off the top of my head and totally ready to be told I'm wrong on this. But it seems to me that the sort of moment where Japanese or Japan really came into like our, like strongly into our pop culture consciousness, certainly at least in my lifetime, was in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, you know, Japan was in this huge economic boom. They were, mm-hmm. you know, they're still the second biggest economy in the world, mm-hmm. I think, even though we've talked about like, oh, they're kind of stagnant
right.
for like, you know, 20 years or whatever. But, you know, that was when we were, it was some combination of like, holy cow, they're amazing over there. They're doing really well, and we were kind of afraid of them, right?
Right.
Like, are they taking over? Like Gung Ho, the movie Gung Ho, you know, all right. that stuff. But we had this idea of them being like super disciplined and really rich.
Right.
And so their food, when they came in, I think, was held in this sort of like, maybe we were wary of it because, oh my God, it's raw fish, that's gross. But on the other hand, it's like, oh, but they're really rich and we have to kind of respect that and respect them. And
interesting.
And I think the restaurants that became known were serving high-end Japanese food largely for a high-end Japanese clientele.
Mm.
And it wasn't like, for instance, like, we've never had a popular imagination of, say, the Chinese American community as being like a high end one, you know, or right. particularly in, at least when you think about going to Chinatowns.
Right. Which is, I know you, when you talk to Chinese restaurateurs, they're constantly battling. They just, not only do they seem stuck there, they can't get out of that we're cheap and plentiful and divey cuisine.
Yeah,
no matter how hard people try.
It's $4.95. If I try to go to $5.95, you're going to revolt on me.
Right, right. You won't come downtown here. Interesting. See, we're not afraid to tackle any difficult questions here on Taste Matters. Certainly not with someone as thoughtful and, I will say, informed, even if he would deny it, as Francis Lam. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Taste Matters.
You're listening to Happy by Jerome LOL on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com. Every Wednesday at noon, Dorothy Cann Hamilton, founder and CEO of the International Culinary Center, interviews the top chefs in the world on Chef Story. Hear from chefs like Christina Tosi.
I'm going to be the best pastry cook this restaurant's ever seen.
Francis Malman.
Cooking with fire, it's very feminine, it's very fragile.
And Jacques Pepin.
I was invited to work at the White House for John Kennedy.
Learn how the greats become great. Every Wednesday at 12 p.m. on Chef Story at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. This is not Chef Story. This is Food Story. I'm Mitchell Davis, your host of Taste Matters. We're talking with Francis Lam, whom, if you don't already, you should follow at Francis_Lam, L-A-M, because he tweets really insightful, funny things, and also about sports. But, but it was actually my husband, Nate, who fell in love with you on Twitter before he met you because of your really insightful commentary about America, really, I would say, not just politics. But we're talking about food here, and we're talking about many different things, class and culture and ethnicity and authenticity. And I wondered if we could turn the conversation a little bit to media, since that's where you've spent much of your life, in food media, and the impact that that has on some of these issues that we're talking about, even on taste and how we eat. It feels like part of the reason some of the, more authentic purveyors of ethnic foods are limited by their access to media. Mm-hmm. And I know this even when we were working with Alain Ducasse and Joël Robuchon at the Beard House for Historic Dinner, no one would have them on TV because of their accents. People were afraid they wouldn't understand and they don't want translators. So we're afraid of the foreign, let's say generally. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, when I was writing this article for the Times, I talked to a lot of people, and Ed Levine actually brought up something really, really important to sort of my thinking on the subject. And he was like, look, let's face it. Like, we, although I think he's a really careful person, a really careful writer, we're working on deadline. We want to get our information from people who know stuff, but we don't always have the time to really dig for it. And so if you need to know something about Thai food, yeah, you can call up maybe the chef from Street Papai, which is a Thai-owned, Thai-run restaurant that, you know, people love in Queens. but maybe you have a hard time getting in touch, or maybe you have a hard time communicating, and you know you can call Andy Ricker, and he will disclaim. He will, you know, he'll throw the disclaimer all the way. He'll say, like, look, I'm not an expert. Right. I'm an amateur. I'm an enthusiast. I love this stuff. This is what I think is the answer to that question. But as a writer, as a journalist, hey, man, you just got your quote.
Take it, right?
You just got your quote, and you got it in clear English. And, hey, the guy looks pretty good in a picture, too, so why not? Right. You know? And I think that's the kind of thing where, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, the Thai-raised, Thai-born, Thai-immigrant chef might not have as easy a time getting media attention and therefore getting buzz and therefore getting business as someone at Andy. The other thing I think is interesting, too, is it's you know, the ability to work with the media, and I don't want to say play the media because I don't necessarily think it's cynical, but the ability to work with the media is sort of part and parcel with this larger thing too of what sort of savvier chefs understand, right? Which is really, what's your market and how do you develop your market? How do you grow your market and how do you sort of get yourself out to your market, right? And the other thing that I think is really interesting, it's in some ways, look, the food you get at Pak Pak. I'm not an expert in traveling in Thailand, but I've heard from people and I would totally understand and buy and totally, probably, you know, whatever. Is it, you know, the food you get at Andy Ricker's restaurant, Pak Pak, is in some ways much more quote-unquote authentic, at least in terms of what it would taste like if you were eating this in Thailand, than if I went to, you know, literally the Thai takeout place around the corner from my house. You know, there are 300 Thai restaurants in New York City, and probably you're going to get more Thai, quote unquote, Thai tasting food at Pak Pak than maybe 292 of those restaurants.
And at the same time, it makes me think that this role, as you mentioned earlier, of translator is really not insignificant and also, in fact, important. That there are, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Italy, and there are a lot of amazing Italian born and raised food experts, but they don't always know what Americans are going to find interesting. That there's a cultural translation that has to happen for someone to adopt a new food or a new cuisine or to even come throw their trust in you in a new restaurant, say.
Yeah, no, totally. Absolutely. And I think here's the thing, right? If I'm an immigrant restaurateur and I grew up in, say, I grew up in Hong Kong, which is where my family's from, and say I had no exposure to American taste, so on and so forth. I come and I open a restaurant, and all the food that I grew up with tastes good to me.
Right.
Right? So I'm going to just try to cook the best versions of those dishes that I can. It would never necessarily, and Hong Kong is a weird example because it's you know, it's such
Anglicized,
a global city.
Right, global, yeah,
but,
right.
But, you know, for instance, you know, but I wouldn't necessarily have a way of knowing that dish A, which features something like fried and sweet and savory, you'd love, and dish B, which has like shrimp paste and you know, other sort of fermenty stinky things, you would think disgusting.
Right.
Until
sticky tofu. Let's make it sticky tofu. Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Right. So now I'm serving these two dishes, and I keep seeing you send one back and order seconds of the other. I'm going to start learning some kind of lesson from that. Right.
Right.
Economically, I just can't take that loss.
Right.
If nothing else. Whereas someone like Andy Ricker, growing up in America, having a sort of different understanding of what a quote unquote American palate is, wouldn't have to modify his dishes. He just can choose the dishes in his repertoire that he thinks would be a great fit for his customer. So that's, in a perverse way, you know, it turns into a thing where he might, in a different way, have more license to cook, again, quote-unquote, more authentic food than me, who I'm just, like, struggling now to, like, make sure you come back and think, God, half your food smells like hell.
Right. No, it's, I think you've raised many more questions than we'll ever even be able to address or talk about, but I think it's a fascinating conversation, and I think it's one that is predicated on this idea that if New York/America is known for anything, it's known for the diversity of its population and its authenticity of those experiences, so that we set up our own bar high. Mm. In France, you expect every restaurant to turn itself French because you don't expect to have an authentic Vietnamese meal there, although you can, but you can also have one served to you on plates without with knives and forks in a way. And so sort of it challenges our own notion of what our own food culture is by just having this conversation in the first place,
expecting
them to be authentic. But let's change the topic a little bit in the few minutes we have left, and talk about, given your broad perspective and your insight into food in general, cookbooks. You're now an editor at large at Clarkson Potter. Maybe it's too soon to ask you this question, but like, what do you, when you thought about this job, really, what were you thinking the world needed? I mean, what is the role of a cookbook today when I'm sitting here with my iPad and I barely flip through a book anymore, even though I adore them and have written several.
Sure. Well, I can't really...
full disclosure. Sorry.
Yeah, fact check. I actually haven't started the job. Ah. It's just been announced, so that's one thing. I'm not going in there to sort of blow up what you do. Like, you can't print books anymore. You know, it's not that kind of purview. But one thing that I think is really interesting is this idea of scale. Mm. And maybe this is a little too meta, but you know, whatever. We're going to go down this road until you say, like, we got two minutes left. This
not
is boring,
for me.
Stop.
No. Never too meta for me. Maybe the people listening and reading at home, but...
But, you know, so there's this thing with scale where, you know, particularly at a large publisher, you know, there obviously every book is its own project and every book has its own budget. Sure. Every book you want to make money on. So, okay, that's the world. That's the reality of the situation. But, you know, it used to be when media was completely dominated by a small handful of, in this case, publishers or magazine or, you know, in journalism, mm-hmm. a small handful of magazines and newspapers. And then you had much more localized local papers or so on and so forth. You know, the big companies would aim for all the million sellers.
Right.
You know, that's what they're doing. They're hitting home runs time mm-hmm. after time after time. And I think the democratization of media is really fraught, not least because it blows up the economics and we haven't figured out a way to get like journalists paid anymore. And mm-hmm. so you can actually live like even halfway comfortable financial life doing this work that we all agree is really important. But also, in some weird, perverse ways, the kind of old way of doing things of like the big companies only getting bigger is only sort of been reinforced, right? Because now it's that much harder
for a small thing to happen, right?
Yeah.
Now you have to make up, there's no leeway, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, you know, so this sort of question of scale, in some ways it's not, the big is only getting bigger, so what are we going to do about the smaller? Mm. And so one thing that Pam Krause, who's the publisher of Clarkson Potter, and who's my short time knowing her is incredibly impressive, and I have talked about this idea of people who write not necessarily for the entire universe, but who can speak to a small but really passionate community. Mm. And, you know, how do we find those people? How do we work with those people? And how do we help develop those people? Mm. You know, my brief time as an editor at Guild Taste, I loved working with writers. Mm-hmm. I loved helping a writer make a story be more of what it wants to be. That's sort of my style. Like, my editing style isn't, okay, well, I want things to sound a certain way. It's more like, what are you trying to do here? What's the story trying to do here? How is the story trying to sound? And mm-hmm. how can we get, you know, how can we turn the dials up and all that stuff? How do you make it more of what you want it to be? And in doing that, like, it was such an incredible honor to work with writers that I really, really admire. Writers like Kate Christensen, writers like Mei Chin, writers like Lila Bayek, writers like Tamar Adler, like really mm-hmm. amazing, Jason Sheehan. I could go on and on down the list. But it was also such an incredible thrill for me to work with new writers, writers mm-hmm. who maybe hadn't worked with an editor before, or writers who maybe hadn't published anything before. And that experience of kind of being able to say, hey, I was there. I was there when this person took this story, took this idea, and made it into this incredible story. And whatever part I could play in that was such an enormous thrill. So that's really what I'm going to be focusing on at Potter.
Well,
finding those kinds of writers.
Good luck. I think that's an exciting prospect for all of us who love food and are you know, love the people we see all the time, but are always, we know there are great people out there who deserve to also be seen. So I can't wait to partake in your successes at Clarkson Potter, which well, I know you will have. Thank you for joining us, for coming out to Brooklyn on a rainy day. Next week, we are welcoming Gabriella Gershenson, who's a senior editor at Sever Magazine, and we're going to talk about the Sever 100, which is a list that everyone always looks forward to every January, and which Heritage Radio Network is very proud to be on this year. So doubly exciting time. In the meantime, follow Francis Lamb on Twitter, think delicious thoughts, eat something good, and find a voice that needs to be heard. Thanks, Francis.
Thank you.
For being here.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.